Dr. Morris Friedman as, well, an interpreter or a moderator, as just as you spoke. Bidding you welcome and saying sit back and enjoy at least an hour of time when you can think with two men who want to come to a little closer grips with them with their own ideas. I just want to introduce one person and when done let him speak of the others. The moderator is Professor Morris S. Friedman, Professor of Philosophy at Sarah Lawrence College, Bronxville, New York. Professor Friedman, as those who have been in the conference well realize, is one of the best American interpreters of Martin Buber. He had his undergraduate work at Harvard, graduate work at Ohio State and the University of Chicago, where he took his doctor's degree, and perhaps is best known in relation to Martin Buber for his book, Martin Buber, The Life of Dialogue. And so, Morris, I'll turn it over to you, and you'll have a good time.
Thank you to us all. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to moderate this, because I could say I perhaps initiated the dialogue between Professor Buber and Professor Rogers some years ago when someone pointed out to me some resemblances in their thought, and I wrote to Dr. Rogers, and he kindly supplied me with some papers, and then we corresponded a while, and then I sent this material to Buber, including some of Professor Rogers' articles, and so I was very happy indeed when the idea of the two of them speaking here in dialogue came up. I think it is a most significant meeting, not just in terms of... Not just in terms of psychotherapy, but the fact that both these men have admiration as persons with an approach to personal relations and personal becoming. There are so many remarkable similarities between their thoughts that it's also intriguing to have the privilege of seeing them talk with one another and seeing what issues may also come out. And my role as moderator is only if occasion should arise to sharpen these issues or interpret one way or another. You don't, I think, need an introduction to Professor Buber, since the conference is centered around him, and I'm sure you don't need introduction to Dr. Rogers either. He's of course, has been famous for a great many years as the founder of the once so-called non-directive therapy, now I believe rechristened client-centered therapy, and is the director of the University of Chicago Counseling Center, where he has had very fruitful relations with the theological group and the personality and religion courses there. And the form of this dialogue will be that Dr. Rogers will himself raise questions with Dr. Buber, and Dr. Buber will respond, and perhaps with a question, perhaps with a statement. We'll let them carry it from there. Dr. Rogers.
One thing I think I would say to the audience before starting to talk with Dr. Buber is that this is most certainly an unrehearsed dialogue. The weather made it necessary for me to spend all day arriving here. And so it was only an hour or two ago that I met Dr. Buber, even though I have met him a long time ago in his writings. I think that the first question I would like to ask you, Dr. Buber, may sound a trifle impertinent, but I would like to explain it, and then perhaps it won't seem impertinent. I've wondered, how have you lived so deeply in interpersonal relationships and gained such an understanding of the human individual without being a psychotherapist. the reason I ask that is that it seems to me that a number of us have come to sense and experience some of the same kinds of learnings that you have expressed in your writings, but very frequently we have come to those learnings through our experience in psychotherapy. I think that there is something about the therapeutic relationship that gives us permission, almost formal permission, to enter into a deep and close relationship with a person. And so we tend to learn very deeply in that way. I think of one psychiatrist friend of mine who says that he never feels as whole or as much of a person as he does in his therapeutic interviews. And I share that feeling. And so if it is not too personal, I would be interested in knowing what were the channels of knowing that enabled you to really learn so deeply of people and of relationships.
Но ведь тогава е биографика, срещу. I think I must give instead of one answer two. The one rather this is only just a particular is that I'm not entirely a stranger in let me say psychiatry, because when I was a student, it's long ago, I studied three terms, psychiatry and what they call in Germany psychiatrische Klinik. I was most interested in the latter. You see, I have not studied psychiatry in order to become a psychotherapist. I studied it three terms. First, with Flexig in Leipzig, where I was a student of Wundt. After that, in Berlin, with Mendel, and third time with Bleuler in Zurich. This was the most interesting of the three. I wanted just then, although I was then very young, inexperienced, and not very understanding young man, that I had a feeling that I want to know about a man, and a man in the so-called pathological state. I doubt it even then if it is the right term. I wanted to see if possible to meet such people and to establish, as far as I can remember, to establish the relation, the real relation between what we call a sane man and what we call a pathological. And this I have learned in some measure as far as a boy of 20 or so can learn such things. But what mainly constituted what you asked, it was something other. It was just certain inclination to meet people. And as far as possible, to just to change, if possible, something in the other, but also to let me be changed by him. At any event, I had no resistance. I put no resistance to it. I already then, as a young man, I felt I have not the right to want to change another if I am not open to be changed by him as far as it is legitimate. If something is to be changed and his touch, his contact is able to change it more or less, I cannot be, so to say, above him and say, no, I am out of the play. You are a man. And so, from my, let me see, there are two phases of it. The first phase went till the year 1819. Meaning till I was about 40.
Hmm? About 40.
Mm-hmm. Just so. Mm-hmm. And then I, in 1819, I felt something rather strange. I felt that I had been strongly influenced by something that came to an end just then, meaning the First World War.
In 1918.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It ended then, and in the course of the war, I did not feel very much about this influence. But at the end, I felt, oh, I have been terribly influenced, because I could not resist to what went on, and I was just compelled to, may I say so, to leave it, you see? Things that went on just in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
You may call it imagining the real,
mm-hmm.
imagining what was going on. This imagining for 4 years influenced me terribly, just when it was finished.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It finished by a certain episode in May 19, when a friend of mine, a great friend, a great man, was killed by the anti-revolutionary soldiers,
mm-hmm.
in a very barbaric way. And I now again, once more, and this was the last time, I was compelled to imagine just this mm-hmm. killing, but not in an optical way alone, but may I say so, just with my body.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the decisive impulse, or rather the decisive moment after that, after some days and nights in this state, I felt, oh, something has been done to me. Mm-hmm. And from then on, these meetings with people, particularly of young people, became a somewhat different form. I had a decisive experience of 4 years, very concrete experience, and from now on I had to give something more than just my inclination to exchange thoughts and feelings and so on. I had to give the fruit of an experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sounds as though you're saying the knowledge, perhaps, or some of it, came in the 20s, but then some of the wisdom you have about interpersonal relationships came from wanting to meet people openly without wanting to dominate. And then, I see this as kind of a threefold answer, and then third, from really living the world war, but living it in your own feelings and imagination.
Just so.
Mm-hmm.
Because this letter was really, I cannot say it in another language, it was really a living with those people. People wounded, killed mm-hmm. in the war.
Mm-hmm. You felt their wounds.
Yes, that feeling is not sufficiently strong. About feeling.
Mm-hmm. You'd like something stronger. I'm going to make one suggestion, even though it interrupts us a little. I can't face the mic and face you at the same time. Would you mind if I turn the table just a little?
Please, please do.
And then I
shall
think
I sit here?
Yes, if you move mm-hmm. forward just a little, then I think it's...
Is this right?
That seems better to me.
Mm-hmm.
Hope it hurts the audience.
Well, he's been changing, I'll interject. This, Professor Rogers' question reminded me of a theological student from a Baptist seminary who talked to me about Professor Buber's thoughts on our time. When he left, he said, I must ask you this question. Professor Buber is so good, how is it that he's not a Christian?
Now, may I tell you a story, not about me, but a true story too, not just an anecdote. A Christian officer, I don't, colonel or so, had to explain some people in, I think, in Wales, had to explain them something in the war, in the Second War. They had to explain them something, soldiers, something about the Jews. It began, of course, with explanation what Hitler means and so on, and he explained to them that the Jews are not just a barbarous race, they had a great culture and so on, and then he addressed a Jewish soldier that was there and knew something and told him, now you go on and tell them something. And this young Jew told them something about Israel and even about Jesus. And to that, one of the soldiers answered, do you mean to tell us that before you, Jesus, we have not been Christian people? Now you go on.
No. Well, I'd like to shift to a question that I have often wondered about. I have wondered whether your concept or your experience of what you have termed the I-thou relationship is similar to what I see as the effective moment in a therapeutic relationship. And I wonder if you would permit me, I might take a moment or two to say what I see as essential in that, and then perhaps you could comment on it from your point of view. I feel that when I'm being effective as a therapist, I enter the relationship as a subjective person, not as a scrutinizer, not as a scientist, and so on. I feel, too, that when I am most effective, then somehow I am relatively whole in that relationship, or the word that has meaning to me is transparent. That is, there is nothing, to be sure there may be many aspects of my life that aren't brought into the relationship, but what is in the relationship is transparent. There is nothing hidden. Then I think, too, that in such a relationship, I feel a real willingness for this other person to be what he is. I call that acceptance. I don't know that that's a very good word for it, but my meaning there is that I'm willing for him to possess the feelings he possesses, to hold the attitudes he holds, to be the person he is. And then I suppose another aspect of it that is important to me is that I think in those moments I really am able to sense with a good deal of clarity the way his experience seems to him, really viewing it from within him and yet without losing my own personhood or separateness in that. And then if in addition to those things on my part, my client or the person with whom I'm working is able to sense something of those attitudes in me, then it seems to me there is a real experiential meeting of persons in which each of us is changed. I don't know. I think sometimes the client has changed more than I am, but I think both of us are changed in that kind of an experience. Now, I see that as having some resemblance to the sort of thing you have talked about in the I-thou relationship, yet I suspect there are differences. At any rate, I would be interested very much in your comments on how that description seems to you in relation to what you have thought of in terms of two persons meeting or an I-thou kind of relationship.
Now, I may try, but longing to ask questions too about what you mean. First of all, I would say this is the action of a therapist is a very good example for a certain mode of dialogic existence. I mean, two persons have a certain situation in common. This situation is, from your point of view. Point is not a good word, but let's see if from your point of view it is a sick man coming to you and asking a particular kind of help. What would you say?
May I interrupt there?
Please do.
I feel that if from my point of view this is a sick person, then probably I'm not going to be of as much help as I might be.
Hmm.
I feel this is a person.
Hmm.
Yes, somebody else may call him sick, or if I look at him sort of from an objective point of view, then I might agree too, yes, he's sick. But in entering the relationship, it seems to me if I am looking upon it as I am a relatively well person and this is a sick person...
No, this I don't mean.
No good.
I don't mean this. Let me leave out the word sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then... coming to you for help.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference, the essential difference between your role in this situation and his is obvious.
Mm-hmm.
He comes for help to you.
Mm-hmm.
You don't come to help for him.
Mm-hmm.
And not only this, but you are able, more or less, to help him. He can do different things to you, but not just help you. And not this alone. You see him, really. I don't mean that you cannot be mistaken, you see, but you see him, just as you said, as he is. He cannot, by far, cannot see you. Not only in that degree, but even in that kind of seeing. You are, of course, a very important person for him, but not a person whom he wants to see and to know and is able to. You are important to him. You are, he is, from the moment he comes to you, he is in, entangled in your life, in your force, in your being, your communication, and so on. But he is not interested in you as you. He cannot be. You are interested, you say so, and you are right, in him as this person. This kind of detached presence, he cannot have and give. And now this is the first point, as far as I see it. And the second is, now, please, you want to...
Yes, I'm not entirely sure.
You may interrupt me in any moment.
All right. I really want to understand that. The fact that I am able to see him with less distortion than he sees me, and that I do have the role of helping him, and that he's not trying to know me in that same sense. That's what you mean by this detached presence?
Yes.
I just want to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Only this. Now, the second fact, as far as I see, as a fact, is in this situation that you have in common with him, only from two sides. You are on one side of the situation, on the may I say so, more or less active. And he in a more or less patient, not entirely active, not entirely passive, of course, but relatively. And this situation, let us now look on this common situation from your point of view and from his point of view. The same situation, you can see it, feel it, experience it from the two sides. From his side, let's begin, from your side, seeing him, observing him, knowing him, helping him, but from your side and from his side. You can experience, I would even venture to say bodily, experience his side of the situation. When you do, so to speak, something to him, you feel yourself touched by what you do to him. He cannot do it at all. You are at your side and at his side at the same time. Here and there, or let's rather say, there and here. Where he is and where you are. He cannot be but where he is. And this, you will, not only you will, you want, your inner necessities may be as they are. I accept them. I have no objection at all. But the situation has an objection. You have necessarily another attitude to the situation than he has. You are able to do something that he is not able. You are not equals and cannot be. You have the great task, self-imposed, the great self-imposed task to supplement this need of his and to do rather more than in a normal situation. But, of course, there are limits. And I may be allowed to tell you, certainly in your experience as a therapist, as a healing person or helping to healing, you must experience it again and again. These limits to simple humanity. To simple humanity, meaning being I and my partner, so to speak, alike to one another, on the same plane. I see. You mean being on the same plane, that you cannot. There is not only your mode of thinking, your mode of doing. There is also a certain situation. Things are so and so. This may sometimes be tragic and even more terrible than or to recall tragic. You cannot change this. Humanity, human will, human understanding are not everything. There is some reality we confront is confronting us, we cannot, we may not forget it for a moment.
Well, what you said certainly stirs up lots of reactions in me. One of them, I think, is this, that, so let me begin first on a point that I think we would agree on.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that, you would agree, too, that if this client comes to the point where he can experience what he is expressing, but also can experience my understanding of it and reaction to it and so on, then really therapy is just about over.
This is just what I mean.
Okay. But the other, one other thing that I feel is this. I've sometimes wondered whether this is simply a personal idiosyncrasy of mine, but it seems to me that when another person is really expressing himself and his experience and so on, I don't feel, in the way that you've described, different from him. That is, I don't know quite how to put this, but I feel as though in that moment, his way of looking at his experience, distorted though it might be, is something I can look upon as having equal authority, equal validity with the way I see life and experience. And it seems to me that that really is the basis of helping, in a sense.
Yes.
And I do feel that's a real sense of equality between us.
No doubt of it. But I'm not speaking now about you feeling, but about a real situation. I mean, you too look, as you just said, on his experience. Neither you nor he look on your experience. The subject is exclusively he and his experience. He cannot, in the course of, let's say, a talk with you, he cannot change his position and ask you, oh, doctor, where have you been yesterday? Oh, you have been in the movies? What was it? And how were you impressed? He cannot do it. So, I see and feel very well your feeling, your attitude, your taking part, that you cannot change the given situation. There is something objectively real that confronts you. Not only he confronts you, the person, but that is the situation, you cannot change it.
Well, now I'm wondering, who is Martin Buber, you or me? Because what I feel, because
I'm not so to say Martin Buber. How do you say this? This science bracket? Yes, no.
Parentheses.
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 Yes. Close.
I'm not a quoted man that thinks so and so and so on.
I know.
We are just speaking about something that interests us perhaps in the same
right.
measure. You in another kind, you are always in contact with, in practical contact with it.
Now,
but
I guess that's the thesis remark. What I wanted to say is this. that I think you're quite right that there is an objective situation there, one that could be measured, one that is real, one that various people could agree upon if they examined the situation closely. But it has been my experience that that is reality when it is viewed from the outside, and that that really has nothing to do with the relationship that produces therapy. That is something immediate, equal, a meeting of two persons on an equal basis, even though in the world of it, that could be seen as a very unequal relationship.
Now, Dr. Rogers, this is the third point where we must say to one another we disagree.
Okay.
You see, I cannot only look on you, on your part of things, of your experience. Let me say, let's take a case that I could talk to him, to your patient too. I would, of course, hear from him a very different tale about the same moment. Now, you see, I am not a therapist. I am interested in you and in him. I must see the situation. I must see you and him in this dialogue hampered by tragedy. Sometime, in many cases, a tragedy that can be overcome. Just in your method. I have no objection at all to your method, you see? There's no need to speak about it. But sometimes a method is not enough, and it cannot do what has been, what is necessary to do. Now, let me ask you a question that seemingly has nothing to do with this, but it's the same point. You have certainly much to do with schizophrenics. Is it so?
Some.
You have you also to do, let me say, with paranoiacs?
Some.
Some. Now, would you say that the situation is the same in your own case and in your other? Meaning, the situation as far as it has to do with this relationship between you and the other man. Is this relationship that you described the same kind of relationship in your own case and in the other? Can you talk, this is a case with a question that interests me very much, because I was impressed very much by paranoia in my youth. I know much more about schizophrenia, but I was very much impressed. I would like to know, have you, this would be, mean very much, can you meet that paranoiac just in the same kind?
Let me first qualify my answer to some degree. I haven't worked in a psychiatric hospital. My dealings have been with people, for the most part, who are able to at least make some kind of an adjustment in the community, so that I don't see the really chronically ill people. On the other hand, we do deal with individuals who are both schizophrenic and others who certainly are paranoid. And one of the things that I say very tentatively, because I realize this is opposed by a great weight of psychiatric and psychological opinion, but I would say that there is no difference in the relationship that I form with a normal person, a schizophrenic, a paranoid. I don't really feel any difference. That doesn't mean, of course, that one... Well, again, it's this question of looking at it from the outside. Looking at it from the outside, one can easily discern plenty of differences. But I'm sure you don't mean that either. And it seems to me that that if therapy is effective, there is this same kind of meeting of persons, no matter what the psychiatric label. And one minor point in relation to something you said that struck me. It seems to me that the moment where persons are most the moments where persons are most likely to change, or I even think of it as the moments in which people do change, are the moments in which perhaps the relationship is experienced the same on both sides. When you said you might talk to my patient and you would get a very different picture, I agree that would be true in regard to a great many of the things that went on in the interviews. But I suspect that in those moments when real change occurred, that it would be because there had been a real meeting of persons in which it was experienced the same from both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So this is really important.
Can I interpose a question here?
Would you wait a moment?
All right, thanks.
I only want to explain to Dr. Rogers why this question is particularly important to me and your answer too. A very important point in my thinking is the problem of limits. Meaning, I do something, I try something, I will something, and I give all my thought, all my existence into this doing. And then I can, at a certain moment, to evolve, to a boundary, to a limit that I cannot ignore. This is true also for what interests me more than anything, human effect of dialogue. Meaning by dialogue, not just talking. Dialogue can be silent. We could perhaps, without the audience, I would recommend to do it without an audience, we could sit together, or rather walk together in silence, and that could be a dialogue. But so even in dialogue, for dialogue, there is a limit set. This is why I'm interested in paranoia. Here is a limit set for dialogue. It is sometimes very difficult to talk to a schizophrenic. He, in certain moments, as far as my experience, that is, of course, that often, how may I say, a dilettante? I can talk to a schizophrenic as far as he is willing to let me in his particular world that is his own, and that in general he does not want to have in common or with other people, but he lets some people in, and so he may let me in too. But if in the moment when he shuts himself, I cannot go on. And the same only in a terribly stronger manner is the case with a paranoid. He does not open himself and does not shut himself. He is shut. There is something has been done to him that shuts him. And this, the terribility of this fate, I'm feeling very strongly, because in the world of normal men, there are just analogous cases. When a sane man behaves not to everyone, but behaves to some people just so, being trapped. And the problem is if he can be opened, if he can open himself, and so on. And this is a problem for the humans in general.
Yes, I think I see that as
yes, now Dr. Friedman, I wanted to...
This is my role as moderator. I'm not... the only role I play here. I'm not quite satisfied as to whether in this interchange just before the paranoid schizophrenic, to what extent it's an issue, to what extent it may be a different use of term. So let me ask Dr. Rogers one step further. As I understood, what Buber said was that the relationship is an eval one, but not a fully reciprocal one, in the sense that while you have the meeting, nonetheless, you see from his standpoint and he cannot see from yours. And in your response to that, you pointed again and again to the meeting that takes place and even to the change that may take place in both sides, but I didn't hear you ever point to suggesting that he does see from your standpoint or that it is fully reciprocal in the sense that he also is helping you. And I wondered if this might not be perhaps just a difference, if not of words, of viewpoint, where you were thinking of how do you feel toward him, that is, that he is an equal person and you respect him.
That means a decisive difference. It's not a question of objecting, helping the other. It's a question of wanting to help the other. He is the man wanting to help the other.
Yes.
And his whole attitude is this active, helping attitude. This is... I wish to say total different by the whole heaven, but I would rather prefer to say by the whole hell different from you attitude. This is a man in hell. A man in hell cannot think, cannot imagine helping another. How could he?
But that, that is where some of the difference arises, because it seems to me, again, that in the most real moments of therapy, I don't believe that this intention to help is any more than a substratum on my part either. In other words, surely I wouldn't be doing this work if that wasn't part of my intention. And when I first see the client, that's what I hope I will be able to do, is to be able to help him. And yet, in the interchange of the moment, I don't think my mind is filled with the thought of, now I want to help you. It is much more, I want to understand you. What person are you behind this paranoid screen, or behind all these schizophrenic confusions, or behind all these masks that you're wearing in real life? Who are you? And I don't feel that it seems to me that is a desire to meet a person, not now I want to help. It seems to me that it is more that I've learned through my experience that when we can meet, then help does occur, but that's a byproduct.
Dr. Rogers, would you not agree, though, that this is not fully reciprocal in the sense that that man does not have that attitude toward you? I want to understand you. What sort of a person are you?
That's the only modification I made of that was that perhaps in the moment where real change takes place, then I wonder if it isn't reciprocal in the sense that I am able to see this individual as he is in that moment,
mm-hmm.
and he really senses my understanding and acceptance of him. And that, I think, is what is reciprocal and is perhaps what produces change.
You see, of course, I entirely with you as far as your experience goes. I cannot be with you as far as I have to look on the whole situation. Your experience and his. You see, you give him something in order to make him equal to you. You supplement his need in his relation to you. You make him of a certain, may I say it so personally, out of a certain fullness, you give him what he wants in order to be able to be just for this moment, so to speak, on the same plan with you, but even that is a very, it is a tension. It is a tension that may not last but one moment. It is not the situation, as far as I see, not the situation of an hour, it is a situation of minutes. And these minutes are made possible by you, mm-hmm. not at all by him.
Mm-hmm. Although I do sense that last I would thoroughly agree with, but I do sense some real disagreement there because it seems to me that what I give him is permission to be, which is a little different somehow from bestowing something on him or something like that.
I think no human being can give more than this. Making a life possible for the other, if only for a moment. And this you do.
If we don't look out, we'll agree.
Well, let's go on.
I really would like to shift it to another topic. Because if, as I understand what you've written and so on, it seems to me that I discern one other type of meeting which has a lot of significance to me in my work, that as far as I know, you haven't talked about. Now, I may be mistaken on that, I don't know. And what I mean by that is that it seems to me one of the most important types of meeting or relationship is the person's relationship to himself.
Mm-hmm.
In therapy again, which I have to draw on because that's my background of experience.
Of course.
There are some very vivid moments in which the individual is meeting some aspect of himself, a feeling he has never recognized before, something, a meaning in himself that he has never known before, and where, it could be any kind of thing. It may be his aloneness or the terrible hurt he has felt,
mm-hmm.
or something quite positive, mm-hmm. courage and so on. But at any rate, in those moments, it seems to me that there is something that partakes of the same quality that I understand in a real meeting relationship, that he is in his feeling and the feeling is in him. It is something that suffuses him, He's never experienced this before. In a very real sense, I think it could be described as a real meeting with an aspect of himself that he has never met before. Now, I don't know whether that seems to you like stretching the concept you've used. I suppose I just would like to get your reaction to it. Whether to you that seems like a possible type of real relationship or a meeting. Because, well, I guess I'll push this one step further. That I guess I have the feeling that it is when the person has met himself in that sense, probably in a good many different aspects, that then, and perhaps only then, is he really capable of meeting another in an I-thou relationship.
Now, here we approach a problem of language.
Mm-hmm.
You call something dialogue that I cannot call so,
mm-hmm.
but I can explain why I cannot call it so, why I would want another term between dialogue and monologue for this. Now, for what I call dialogue, there is essentially necessary the moment of surprise. I mean,
surprise.
Yes, being surprised.
Mm-hmm.
A dialogue. Let's take a rather a trivial image. The dialogue is like a game of chess. The whole charm of chess is that I do not know and cannot know what my partner will do. I am surprised by what he does, and on this surprise, the whole play is based. Now, you hint at this, that a man can surprise himself,
mm-hmm.
but in a very different manner from how a person can surprise another person.
The first two aspects of that, I hope that perhaps sometime I could play some recordings of interviews for you to indicate how the surprise element really can be there. That is, a person can be expressing something and then suddenly be hit by the meaning of that, which has come from someplace in him that he doesn't recognize. In other words, he really is surprised by himself. That can definitely happen. But the element that I see as being most foreign to your concept of dialogue is that it is quite true that this otherness in himself is not something to be prized.
Mm-hmm.
I think there, in this kind of dialogue I'm talking about within, that it is that otherness that probably would be broken down. And I do realize this probably is in part the whole discussion of this may be based on a difference in our use of words too. I mean that.
And you see, may at a technical matter,
mm-hmm.
I have learned in the course of my life to appreciate terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that modern psychology does it not in a sufficient measure. When I find something that is essentially different from another thing, I want a new term. I want a new concept. You see, for instance, modern psychology in general says about the unconscious that it is a certain mode of the psychic. It has no sense at all for me. If something is so different from those two things are so different from one another as this stream of the soul changing in every moment where I cannot grasp anything, when I try to grasp it's away from one side, this being in pure time and this what we call the unconscious, that is not a phenomenon at all. We have no access to it at all. We have only to deal with its effects and so on. We cannot say this is psychic and this is psychic. The unconscious is something in which psychic and physiologic are, how may I say, mixed is not enough. They penetrate one another in such a manner that we see in relation to this terms body and soul are, so to speak, late terms, late concepts. And concepts is a primal reality. Now, how can we comprehend this in one concept, one term? But this is only...
I agree with you very much on that, but I think when an experience is definitely of a different sort, then it does deserve a different term. I think we agree on that. Perhaps, since I see time is going by, I'd like to raise one other question that has a great deal of meaning to me, and I don't know quite how to put it. I think perhaps it's something like this. As I see people coming together in relationship, in therapy, I think that one of the things I've come to believe and feel and experience is that what I think of as human nature or basic human nature, that's a poor term, you may have a better way of putting it, is something that is really to be trusted. And it seems to me in some of your writings I can catch that something of that same feeling, but at any rate, it's been very much my experience in therapy that one does not need to supply motivation toward the positive or toward the constructive that exists in the individual. In other words, that if we can release what is most basic in the individual, that it will be constructive. Now, I don't know. Again, I just hope that perhaps that would stir some comments from you.
I don't yet see the exact question in this.
The only question that I'm raising is, do you agree, I suppose? Or if I'm not clear, please ask me other questions. I'll try to put it perhaps in another way. Well, this would be a contrasting way. It seems to me that much of the point of view of Orthodox psychoanalysis at least, has held the point of view that when the individual is revealed, I mean, when you really get down to what is within the person, that consists mostly of instincts and attitudes and so on, which must be controlled. Now that runs diametrically contrary to my own experience, which is that when you get to what is deepest in the individual, that's the very aspect that can most be trusted to be constructive, or to tend toward socialization, or toward the development of better interpersonal relationships, and so on. Does that have any meaning to you?
I see. I would put it in a somewhat different manner. As far as I see, when I have to do with a, now let me say, a problematic person, not just a sick person, problematic person, a person that people call, want to call a bad person. You see, in general, the man who have really to do with what we call the spirit are called not to the good people, but just to the bad people, to the problematic, to the inaccessible, and so on. The good people, we can be friends with them, but they don't, obviously they don't need us. I'm interested just in the so-called bad, problematic, and so. And I, my experience is, if I succeed to, and this is near to what you say, but somewhat different. If I come near to the reality of this person, I experience it as a polar reality.
A polar?
Polar reality. You see, in general, we say this is either A or non-A. It cannot be A and non-A at the same time. It can. It can. I mean, what you say may be trusted, I would say this stands in polar relation to what can be least trusted in this man. You cannot say, and perhaps I differ from you in this point, you cannot say, oh, I detect in him just what can be trusted. I would say, now when I see him, I grasp him more broadly and more deeply than before, I see his whole polarity, and then I see how the worst in him and the best in him are dependent on one another, attached to one another, and I can help, may be able to help him just by helping him to change the relation between the poles. Not just by choice, but by a certain strength that he gives to the one fall in the relation to the other, the being qualitatively very alike to one another. I would say there is not, as we generally think, in the soul of a man, good and evil opposed. There is, again and again, in different manners, a polarity, and the poles are not good and evil, but rather, yes and no, rather acceptance and refusal. And we can help him strengthen the one positive pole. And even perhaps we can strengthen the force of direction in him, because this polarity is very often directionless. It is a chaotic state. We could bring in a cosmic note into it. We can help put order, put a shape into this, because I think the good, what we may call the good, is always only a direction, mm-hmm. not a substance. Mm-hmm.
Right. And if I get the last portion of that particularly, you're saying that perhaps we can help the individual to strengthen the yes, that is, to affirm life rather than refuse it. Is that
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you see, I differ only in this word. I would not say life. I would not put an object to it.
Uh-huh.
I would say
mm-hmm.
simply yes.
Mm-hmm. 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 You're looking as though you want to say
mm-hmm.
Well, I could.
I'm tempted
we could,
to.
We could go on forever.
My function as moderator, one is to sharpen issues, and I feel that there are two interrelated things that have been touched on here, but maybe not brought out. And I feel they're sufficiently important. I'd like to see when Dr. Rogers first asked Professor Buber about his attitude toward psychotherapy, he mentioned, as one of the factors that enters into his approach to therapy, acceptance. Now, Professor Buber, as we saw last night, often uses the term confirmation. And it is my own feeling from both what they've said tonight and my knowledge of their writings that it might be of real mm-hmm. importance to clarify whether mm-hmm. they mean somewhat the same.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rogers writes, about acceptance, in addition to saying that it's a warm regard for the other and respect for his individuality, for as a person of unconditional worth, that it means an acceptance of and regard for his attitudes of the moment, no matter how negative or positive, no matter how much they may contradict other attitudes he has held in the past, and this acceptance of each fluctuating aspect of this other person makes it for him a relationship of warmth and safety. Now, I wonder whether Professor Buber would look on confirmation as similar to that, or would he see confirmation as including, perhaps not being acceptance, including some demand on the other that might mean, in a sense, a non-acceptance of his feelings at the moment in order to confirm him later.
Mm. I would say every 2, let's say, existential relationship between 2 persons begins with acceptance. By acceptance, I mean, perhaps the two concepts are not just alike, but by acceptance, I mean being able to tell, or to, rather not to tell, but only to make it felt to the other person, that I accept him just as he is. I take you just as you are, once for all. But it is not yet what I mean by concern, you have. Because accepting, this is just accepting how the other is in this moment, in this actually how he is. Confirming means, first of all, accepting the whole potentiality of the other, and making even a decisive difference in his potentiality, distinguishing between, and this is of course we can be mistaken again and again in this, but it's just a chance between human beings. I can recognize in him, know in him more or less the person he has been. I can say it only in this form, created to become. In the simple factual language, we find not the terms for it, because we don't find in it the term, the concept, being meant to become. This is what we must, as far as we can, grasp. If not in the first moment, then after this. And now, I not only accept the other as he is, but I confirm him in myself and then in him, in relation to this potentiality that is meant by him, and it can now be developed, it can evolve, it can enter a reality of life. He can do more or less to this scope, but I can too. Do something. And this is, this goes even deeper than acceptation. Let's take, for example, a man and a woman, man and wife, and he says, not expressly, but just by his whole relation to her, I accept you as you are. But this does not mean I don't want you to change. But it says, I discover in you just by my accepting love, I discover in you what you are meant to become. This is, of course, not anything to be expressed in massive terms. But it may be that it grows and grows with the years of common life.
Well, I think that
is
sounds...
Is it what you...
Yes, yes.
Mm. And I think that sounds very much like a quality that is in the experience that I think of as acceptance, though I have tended to put it differently. I think that we do accept the individual and his potentiality. I think it's a real question whether we could accept the individual as he is, because often he is in pretty sad shape, perhaps, if it were not for the fact that we also, in some sense, realized and recognized his potentiality. I guess I feel, too, that that acceptance of the most complete sort, acceptance of this person as he is the strongest factor making for change that I know. In other words, I think that does release change or release potentiality to find that as I am, exactly as I am fully accepted. Then I can't help but change. Because then I feel then there is no longer any need for defensive barriers. So then what takes over are the forward-moving processes of life itself, I think.
I'm afraid I'm not so sure of that as you are. Perhaps because I'm not a therapist. And I have necessarily to do with the problematic side in problematic man. I cannot do in my relationship to it, to him, my relationship to him, without just this. I cannot put it aside. I have just, as I said, I have to do with those men, I have to do with the problematic in him. And I have, there are cases when I must help him against himself. He wants my help. Against himself, he wants, you see, the first thing of all is that he trusts me. His life has become baseless for him. He cannot treat on firm soil, on firm earth. He is, so to say, suspended in the air. And what does he want? What he wants is a being, not only whom he can trust as a man trusts another, but a being that gives him now the certitude there is a soil. There is an existence. The world is not condemned to deprivation, degeneration, destruction. The world can be redeemed. I can be redeemed because there is this birth. And if this is reached, now I can help this man even in his struggle against himself. And this I can only do if I distinguish between accepting and confirming.
I just feel that one difficulty with a dialogue is that there could easily be no end, but I think that both in mercy to Dr. Buber and to the audience, they should...
I say
out of consideration for you and consideration
not for me.
All right. I say out of consideration for you and consideration
not for me.
All right. just consideration for the audience.
May I be so unmerciful as to just ask one last question? And that is, my impression is that on the one hand there has been more insistence by Dr. Rogers on the fuller reciprocity of the eye-to-eye relation of therapy and less by Dr. Buber. But on the other, I get the impression that Dr. Rogers is more client-centered as the...
What?
More client-centered, more concerned... more concerned with the becoming of the person. And he speaks in his second article of being able to trust one's organism that it will find satisfaction, that it will express me. And he speaks of the locus of value as being inside one, whereas I get the impression from my encounter with Dr. Buber that he sees value as more in the between. I wonder, is this a real issue between the two of you?
I might just give one type of expression to my view on that puts it in quite different terms than much of using it, I think is really relates to the same thing, that as I've tried to think about it in recent months, it seems to me that you could speak of the goal toward which therapy moves, and I guess the goal toward which maturity moves in an individual as being becoming or being knowingly and acceptingly that which one most deeply is. In other words, that too expresses a real trust in the process which we are, that perhaps may not entirely be shared between us.
Now, perhaps it would be of a certain aid if I had a problem that I found when reading just this article of yours, or a problem that approach me. You speak about persons, and the concept person is seemingly very near to the concept individual. I would think that it's advisable to distinguish between them. An individual is just a certain uniqueness of a human being, and if it can develop just by developing this uniqueness. This is what Jung calls individuation. A path that he may become more and more an individual without making him more and more a human. I have a lot of examples of men having become very, very individual, very distinct of others, very developed in their such and suchness without being at all what I would like to call a man. Therefore, person, I would say, individual is just this uniqueness, being able to be developed so and so. But person, I would say, is only an individual living really with the world. Not, and with the world, I don't mean in the world, but just in real contact, in real reciprocity of the world in all the points in which the world can meet man. I don't say only with man, because sometime we meet the world in other shapes than it's that of man. But this is what I would call a person. And if I may say expressly yes and no to certain phenomena, I am against individuals and for persons.
Rogers and Dr. Buber for a unique dialogue. It is certainly unique in my experience, first because it is a real dialogue taking place in front of an audience, and I think that is in part because of what they were willing to give us and did give us, and in part it's because you took part in sort of in a trialogue, or adding me a quadrilogue, in which you silently participated.